has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
Born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with island flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
And welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, April 9th. I'm Dave Raven. It's great to be back with you, back from 3 weeks in Vietnam. Just incredible. We're going to do a show around Vietnam coming up soon. Just extraordinary. I do recommend it. Get a hold of me at draben, D-R-A-B-I-N 902 at gmail.com. I'll give you all sorts of tips. It's just an extraordinary experience, particularly for us elders that had to deal with the horrific war back in the 60s and 70s, and I guess the 50s, and well before that. Anyway, later in the show, the upcoming Arabian Sides Film Festival will feature two timely films give voice to Palestinians. We'll talk with the festival's executive director, Shireen Gharib, and on April 16th at the Kennedy Center's Terrace Theater, the Post Classical Ensemble, joined by jazz composer and pianist Ellington Carthen, will perform some of Duke Ellington's extraordinary yet little-known concert pieces, including Black, Brown, and Beige, and the suite from the ballet The River. We'll chat with the ensemble's music director, Angel Il Ordonez. But first, a moment of silence, if we could, for the people of Gaza. And on with the show. I mean, I'm realizing, you know, there's so many people to be aware of. I mean, it's not just people in Gaza. We did a show somewhat recently on Congo. Since the early 90s, something like 6 million people have perished. And there's horrors going on elsewhere, Sudan, Ethiopia. But Gaza seems to be front and center at the moment. I guess primarily because of U.S. involvement in supporting Israeli government militarily. On with the show. It might be an understatement to say that D.C. is facing some serious financial challenges. We've got pandemic-era federal aid exhausted, declining commercial tax collections. If you've been downtown, you get it. Recently, and expenses growing at a fast rate. Throw in a WMATA budget shortfall and the chief financial officer of the district's requirement that $250 million go towards refilling DC's reserves, and you've got trouble right here in River City, or should I say, to River City. DC Mayor Bowser says the city is looking at a $4 billion, that's billion with a B, budget hole through fiscal 2029, including a $700 million shortfall this year. Bowser is proposing in her fiscal year 2025 budget a number of solutions, but critics say the proposed cuts to various programs supporting lower-income residents are unacceptable, and there's a lack of vision in how increased revenue could be created. For example, what about taxing wealth in a city where of African Americans? I mean, it's just It boggles the mind. Joining us to talk about the mayor's approach and alternative to it is the executive director of the D.C. Institute. Erica Williams, welcome to Project Comment. Are you with us?
I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my. Williams. It was Singer, but it's great to have you with us. And we welcome callers. We'd really like to hear folks' input on this. Please don't hesitate. Call in. Center yourself. Oh, is this a good question? Just call in. It would be great to hear you. 202-588-0893. It'd be great to hear from our listening audience. Before we get into Mayor Bowser says fiscal policy is that she's looking to balance the budget on the backs of blacks and brown residents. Those are some strong words.
Well, it's hard to look at this budget and see anything else. Despite sort of a tagline for the budget, her fair shot budget, so-called, despite a tagline of shared sacrifice and strategic investments, the sacrifices that are being made in this budget are not remotely shared, and I would say are highly unstrategic. What we see in this budget is that the mayor is demanding the biggest sacrifices from D.C.'s lowest income residents, who are, because of systemic racism, disproportionately black and brown folks. And, while prioritizing and maintaining investments for downtown and for wealthy businesses. So there are real choices being made here, and those choices are to cut vital lifelines and programs for folks who really need them in order to balance the budget. I will say, in addition to that, some of the revenue raising that the mayor does in her budget proposal also disproportionately harms the same folks that are going to be hurt by the program eliminations that she's proposing. So it's sort of folks with low incomes are getting hit on both sides of the coin here.
I mean, I'm reminded of a little movie where the main big line was Watergate, whatever it was called, follow the money. I mean, if you look at her, who is funding our mayor, it's, let's not get into it, but it's probably not a terribly a pretty picture when you're looking at the broad support from lower income people. So we're talking about $500 million, that's half a billion in cuts. Let's get into the specifics of the cuts, because when you really look at them, I mean, it's extraordinarily tragic, because these are some wonderful programs, the first being the Early Childhood Educator Pay Equity Fund. We're talking about not cutting it, not diminishing it. We're talking about eliminating it, if I have that right. If you could talk about this program, it's a first-in-the-nation program, really extraordinary. If you could touch on that.
Yeah, the Pay Equity Fund is a really innovative program that is part of a broader plan as envisioned in the Birth to Three Act that we passed in 2018 that aims to make our childcare sector super high quality and affordable. So the idea is that we would have very high quality care for our very youngest children, 0 to 3, before they hit pre-K. So they would have high quality care, and also we would make that care cost no more than 7% of any family's income in the district. This is the vision in the Birth to Three law that council passed in 2018. The Pay Equity Fund is a key step forward of implementing that law, where we would increase the compensation of early educators who are in our child care sector to ensure that they are both incentivized to get higher credentials so that they are providing the highest quality care possible, and also that they're being compensated according to their credentials. So their pay scale is now set through this program, is set to have parity with the pay scale of our public pre-K teachers. So if you have a bachelor's degree, you would get a salary that's on par with our public pre-K teachers that have a bachelor's degree. This is just about basic fairness, that just because you're in the child care industry doesn't mean you should get paid, lower wages for the same kind of work and with the same level of credentials and experience. This program is already implemented. Folks are already getting the higher pay and, for many, access to health care that they didn't already have. And so when she is proposing to eliminate this program, she's proposing to strip pay from 4,000, mostly black and brown women, who are caring for our very youngest children here in the district, and to strip some of them from having health care. It is not like stopping a program before it's implemented. This is literally, you know, taking money out of people's pockets that they need to care for their own families and to be able to stay here in D.C. and do this work that we desperately need them to do, so that, you know, parents can go to work and so that businesses can continue to run. Child care is essential to our economy, and this is just like a very short-sighted move to wipe out a program that is set to pay people what they deserve to earn and also improve our child care sector and the quality of care our kids get, and with this bigger vision of getting to affordable quality child care for all families.
I mean, it's just, it's so important. I mean, we're talking about kids that, you know, at a very impressionable age that deserve and need good care. We're talking about a community that, you know, their parents need to be, you know, it's a two income family that need to be working. I mean, it's just so glaringly blinking lights important that the mayor's talking about eliminating it. You know, I mean, I understand if we were at war or something that conceivably might be necessary. But, you know, when you look at the other priorities in her budget, it boggles the mind that kids are not at the top as they should be. Kids and the educators, we're talking about 4,000 educators here. This is not a small program.
It's not a small thing. It's not a small thing for families. It's not a small thing for our economy. It's not a small thing for the 4,000 workers who would see their pay cut. And it's not a small thing for the kids who are in the care of these fantastic workers that we have here in D.C. So, you know, this is just it boggles the mind that this would be the place to go to find money to balance the budget. This isn't the only program on the chopping block. One of the other first of their kind in the nation programs is our baby bonds program, our child wealth savings program.
Yep.
That this is the second year in a row that the mayor has zeroed out the budget for that program. I guess this year she didn't zero it out, but she cut it by over 2/3. And limits its reach and what it's going to do for the kids that will still get a payout, but she pretty much decimates the program. This is a program that was put into place in 2021 to really reduce the substantial racial wealth gap that we have here in the district and to sort of interrupt the intergenerational cycle of poverty for young people in D.C., particularly young Black and brown people, growing up in economic hardship, so that when they reach adulthood, that they have a nest egg there that can help them pursue education, help them maybe put a down payment on a home, maybe help them start a business and follow sort of their entrepreneurial dreams, you know, have the safety of a nest egg there to really follow their own path and to live out their lives the way they'd like to live them, and to not be burdened by the hardship, continue to be burdened by the hardship that they grew up in. It's pretty unconscionable that
this is addressing something I spoke about in the introduction. I mean, the wealth gap is 80-1 between whites and blacks in the district, to put it bluntly. It's just extraordinary. And this is talking about, you know, some kind of a trust that gets set up at birth and accrues, and then you turn 18 and you can use it, as you said, you know, for further education after high school, for property, for possible entrepreneurial efforts. I mean, it's really going at the heart of the underbelly of the disparity in our economy. And the mayor is talking about cutting 2/3 out of this. It's just, it's egregious.
It's pretty egregious. And again, like I said, this is the second time the mayor has come for this program. It's really unfortunate, because we have an opportunity to think a little longer term through a program like this and try to right some historic wrongs. The other thing that the mayor takes aim at that is really egregious is a planned increase to our earned income tax credit. So we, in 2021, pursued a modest income tax increase on the highest income households. And through that, we were able to pay for the pay equity fund, which is, you know, she proposes to eliminate, and also an expansion of our earned income tax credit to, which is a great program that ensures that working families with, you know, living on low and moderate incomes are able to make ends meet, are able to put food on the table, feed their kids. It's an income boost, basically, through the tax code that's got tons of research behind it in terms of its ability to sort of change life trajectories for kids, help families get by, reduce poverty and hardship. We had planned for this to, this program, our earned income tax credit to reach 100% of the federal credit. So it would be 100% match for the federal tax credit by the same name. And that would be a huge income boost for DC's low and moderate income working families that really struggle to stay here, really struggle to keep their foothold in D.C., but deserve to live here just like everyone else. The mayor cuts that short, basically ends the expansion at the point we're at right now. And again, you know, like, this is short-sighted. This is a major investment in folks who really need it, and has a great track record in terms of reducing poverty, putting kids on the right track. You know, kids and families that are getting the resources they need grow up in less stress. They get the food they need. They go to school ready to learn. They do better in school. They go further in school. They work and earn more as adults. And that's all in research on the earned income tax credit, right, showing these kinds of results. And we're cutting that short to balance the budget.
Right, right. We got to be aware of our time. Just so you know, I mean, there's so much to talk about. Let's just touch briefly, if you would, on cuts. We're cutting in half the emergency rental assistance program, which helps tenants avoid eviction. If you could touch on that.
Yeah, we have, you know, this emergency rental assistance program in place, and a companion to it is our Access to Justice program, which is legal services for folks facing eviction and other issues. Both get slashed in the mayor's budget proposal. You know, we know that even the amount that was budgeted for last year, I think it was about more than $40 million, was not enough to meet need and demand here in the district. We ran out of funds within a few months of the program being opened for applications. Now we're talking about trying to meet need with less than half of what was allotted last year, and it's just not going to be enough. We have high demand for housing need. We have more than 40,000 households in D.C. who earn less than 30% of median family income and pay more than half their income in rent. So the idea that, you know, the mayor's put out there that people don't really need this program, that they're abusing it and they should just get jobs and pay their rent, is really not lining up with the realities on the ground, that we have people who desperately need assistance, who can't afford their rent, who are paying so much of their income just to have a roof over their head, and it's not working. We have huge demand for this program. You know, I would suggest that if the mayor has problems with the program, that she take a look at how to improve it instead of just slashing the funding for it. We really need to be able to support folks so that they can stay here in the district. So that's another program that's sort of on the chopping block. And that, you know, frankly, goes in the wrong direction for the district. We know we have a housing affordability crisis. We should be doing more to address it and not less.
I should say I'm speaking with the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute's Executive Director, Erica Williams. Would love to hear from our listener, 202-588-0893, at 202-588-0893, if you're in any of these effective groups or whatever comments you might have. We'd love to hear from you. In the limited amount of time we have left, Ms. Williams, how is the mayor proposing to raise money to pay for, you know, what's in the budget? I guess she wants to talk about increasing the sales tax. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, the sales tax is a what we call a regressive source of revenue. You know, as part of our revenue system, it is one piece, but to raise that tax right now is going to take aim at the very folks that are already being harmed through the other kinds of cuts being proposed, right? So it is a tax that eats up a larger share of income of those who have little income, those who are spending every dollar they earn or nearly every dollar they earn just to get by in D.C. Those folks are going to be most harmed by this sales tax increase. And I would say that combined with the backtrack on the earned income tax credit in particular, which helps folks keep more of what they earn, we're likely to see the share of income paid in taxes by low and moderate income folks go up on a whole. They're going to be spending more of what they earn in taxes than on other things that they and their families need. And that is not a good, sustainable source of revenue for us. We have lots of other tools at our disposal. We can be looking at wealth and how we tax it. We can be looking at taxing high incomes. We can be looking at other sources. She does also include an increase to the paid family leave tax, payroll tax on employers. That's doing a lot of the work to fill the budget hole. And that's less regressive than the sales tax, but the sales tax piece is particularly troubling. We don't have to go that route.
Yeah. I mean, when you see, you know, sales tax, you know, I automatically think, you know, that tends to be pretty regressive. It affects lower income people the most. You know, I'm middle income, you know, paying a little bit more for sales is one thing. It's another thing for a lower income family with kids to deal with it. It's just, it's most unfortunate. We need to emphasize here that she's in this budget totally avoiding, if I understand correctly, increasing taxes on income, increasing property taxes, and increasing commercial property taxes. You can maybe understand the latter given the devastation that's happened with the pandemic, but you know, not touching income taxes, not touching property taxes. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a mistake. You know, we have a lot of folks who are, you know, have great incomes here in the district and, you know, benefit very much from living here and being in this economy. We also have a lot of folks who are lucky to be homeowners and to see the values of their homes appreciate vastly over time. You know, we had tons of folks during the pandemic who saw their wealth, the equity in their homes skyrocket, and their incomes go up. And so we need to be thinking about how we can tap into that, you know, asking folks who are doing well here to contribute more to, you know, maintain the investments, public investments in programs and services that not only benefit folks with low incomes and who are struggling to get by here, but also support all of the public services that all of us rely on every day. So, you know, when I hear her rejecting things like increasing the property tax, when we have the lowest property tax, residential property tax rate in the region, I think that's short-sighted and misguided. And there are ways that we could, and DCFPI has a proposal to increase residential property taxes, holding folks who are low income or seniors or veterans or living with a disability harmless, and really targeting homes with the highest values. We don't have to treat everyone the same with, we can make our property tax more progressive like our income tax. So we have a proposal for doing that that could raise us revenue to deal with some of the issues we're facing in this budget, tough budget environment.
Well, Erica Williams, you're just going to have to give more money to the mayor's electoral campaign to get some more attention. I mean, we do need to do a whole separate show, I'm realizing, on campaign contributions, because it's, you know, it pays the piper, plays the tune. I think it can be said, a whole nother discussion. So we're talking about, you know,
born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with island flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
Hi, Erica Williams. Are you still with us?
I'm still here.
Great. I'm sorry for the interruption. We're virtually out of time. Very close to it. Talk about just briefly, if you would, your the whole idea of a taxing wealth. I mean, you know, as I said earlier, I've said a couple of times, I think, during the show, the disparity is extraordinary, 80 to 1 between white and black folks. If you could talk about the idea of taxing wealth and what the prospects for are looking at the political lay of the land in terms of the city council and the mayor?
Yeah. You know, we have a long history of racism and economic exclusion that has led to the racial wealth gap that we see here in the district and the area, where white households hold 81 times the wealth of black households, where, you know, 0.4% of filers in the district hold 46% of all wealth to the tune of $183 billion. And a lot of that is an unrealized capital gain. So we have a lot of wealth here, a lot of extreme wealth, and we don't do much to tax that and to tap into that to, you know, raise collective resources that can be invested across our communities here in the district. And one of the ways that we can better do that is to strengthen our capital gains tax. What we've proposed is a higher flat rate on capital gains to bring in additional revenue to you know, pay for the kinds of services that we want to, and the kinds of investments that we want to see here in D.C. to make sure that everyone can live to their fullest, and not just those who have been able to, you know, accumulate and concentrate wealth over time because our system allows it. So we have the tool in place. We have a capital gains tax. We have ways to strengthen it. We can do that easily. I do think it is a question of public will, political will, whether we can get folks to actually make that choice. And that is, you know, going to be a conversation in the weeks and months ahead as we race to the finish line of a very quick and condensed budget season, to see if we can't get more revenue in so that we don't have to make these quote-unquote tough choices that really, you know, do harm to black and brown and low-income communities here in D.C.
So we are, how long? Can you hear me, Erica?
I can hear you now. I lost you for a second there.
Okay, it's coming in and out, huh? What's our schedule in terms of this proposed 2025 fiscal year budget?
Well, the votes on the budget will be near the end of May and in the beginning, the first half of June. So we have not very long to sort it all out. I think council has a very tough job of figuring out ways to shift the choices that were made in the mayor's proposal. I do think that there's a lot of dismay at the choices that were made. And so I do think there will be effort on the part of council to undo some of the damage done. But there's a short timeline ahead of us for making that happen.
And are you hopeful that the council is going to be able to counter some of these proposals, some of these eliminations, some of these cuts proposed by the mayor?
I am hopeful. I think, like I said, I think that there's a lot of dismay about you know, eliminating the pay equity fund, not doing more to support folks who are struggling to stay housed. And I do think that there's, you know, an understanding on the council that many of these choices were very short-sighted and really put, you know, put us in a weaker position over the longer term. So I think that there is interest in vastly improving what the budget looks like. I do think there's some, you know, work to be done to figure out how to do that. And that'll be a combination of sort of, you know, thinking about where investments and enhancements were made and whether those are really worthwhile. And also thinking about ways that we can potentially raise revenue or bring in more resources to fund key programs. So I am hopeful about that. It doesn't mean it's not a tough road ahead. I think that council hearing from folks across the city about what they'd like to see done. That always helps. I mean, hearing from the public right. is really important.
Right. I mean, so people need to be contacting, obviously the at-large members, the mayor herself, to let their feelings be known about this proposed budget of hers. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, for all you're doing. I've been speaking with the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute's Executive Director, Erica Williams. Really appreciate you joining us today. Check them out, D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. You can really stay on top of what's happening politically in the district by checking out their website. Erica Williams, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, David.
Great having you. And on to our next guest, running April 18th to April 28th, D.C.'s longest-running film festival. Film Fest D.C. will return for its 38th year since 2020. The Arabian Sites Film Festival has been presented in conjunction with Film Fest D.C., which will be the case again this year. Arabian Sites will feature two timely films that give voice to the people of Palestine. Timely indeed. And joining us to talk about the films and the festival is its executive director of Arabian Sites, Shireen Gariba. Welcome to Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
Really appreciate all you're doing and for joining us today. So if there's several films, I think, in Arabian Sites, but if you could focus on the two Arabian films, timely, given with the horror that's going on in Gaza and for that matter, the West Bank.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I do want to mention that Film Fest DC, as we're known for short, will take place, as you said, April 18th through 28th. And during the entire film festival, we will present 62 films, and over 36 countries will be represented over this 11-day period. Arabian Sites, Film Fest DC is an umbrella organization for Arabian Sites, and Arabian Sites is the oldest film festival in the U.S. presenting films from the Arab world to an American audience. It was meant to be only a one-time event, but the interest level was so high that it became an annual event. And this year will be our 29th edition. As you mentioned, it's being presented in conjunction with Film Fest DC. We're presenting two films from Palestine. One is titled The Teacher. It is directed by Farah Nabulsi, and we're very pleased that she will be here in person to meet our audience. This is a film that will stay with you long after you've seen it. It's a drama based on true events that take place in the occupied West Bank. The home of one of the teacher's students was bulldozed before his eyes without warning, and the teacher takes him under his wing in order to counsel and protect him. It's a well-written, well-acted film that plays out like a political thriller, and it's impossible not to relate the events in this film with the current conflict in Gaza. The director is a very eloquent and outspoken human rights activist and a talented filmmaker. Her first film was a short titled The Present, which was nominated for an Oscar in 2021 and shortlisted for the British Academy Film Awards, and it had nominations for over 40 international awards. So we're really pleased that she will be here to introduce her film, conduct a Q&A, and I know talk about what's currently going on in Gaza.
And what date will that be? When is that being shown?
I would like to, we're going to be showing it twice, the first weekend of the festival, the 19th and the 20th. But I would love to direct everybody to our website at filmfestdc.org to get all the details and to see when this film is being shown, at what time, and all our other films that we're going to be presenting. And it will be shown at Landmark's East Street Cinema.
Wonderful. I mean, it's just, I think it's so important to personalize the whole Palestinian experience, as it is so many of the tragedies occurring around the globe. Telling film that's going to be in the festival, if you would.
I lost you for a minute, but I think you were saying to tell you about the other Palestinian film or other Arab films. I'm not sure.
Yeah, if you could talk about, I'm going to have to reconsider doing this Zoom thing. You're cutting in and out.
Not a problem.
You know, it's supposed to be so.
Well, I can
so
let you
high
know.
Technology, and it's great to see people's faces, but Lord, I'm.
Well, you're not the only one that has issues. So. I've lost you again. I'm so sorry.
I'm very good. A little for me. Man, that's a wake-up call about Zoom. Are you hearing me now?
You just came back. we will have another.
Hi.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. If you could talk about the other film.
Sure. The other Palestinian film is called Bye Bye Tiberias, and it's a documentary about Hiyam Abbas, who is a Palestinian actress who has broken boundaries. She starred in numerous films from Palestine, Israel, several European countries, as well as the U.S. And she's known for her roles, and I'll just mention a couple of films, The Syrian Bride, Paradise Now, Steven Spielberg's Munich, The Visitor, Insuriated, The Blade Runner 2049. She also gained a lot of notoriety for her role in HBO's Succession, where she assumed the role as Marsha Roy, and in the Hulu comedy series Rami. And this film is directed by Hiyam Abbas's daughter, Lina Sualem, and it tells the story of Hiyam's decision to leave Galilee, leave her parents and siblings decades earlier to pursue her work. But it also tells the story of the resilience and complexity of Arab women's lives. This film was Palestine's submission to the Academy Awards. Other Arabian Nights films will include Inshallah a Boy, a Jordanian film, which premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, Goodbye Julia from Sudan, Hajan is an intriguing adventure from Saudi Arabia that takes place in the world of small circuit camel racing in the Arabian desert. And we're pleased to have the American premiere of Chanting of the Dunes, which follows the story of an individual whose name you might not recognize, but you do need to know about him, Wahbi Al-Hariri Rifa'i, an accomplished international artist, architect, archaeologist, and author, and the first living artist to be honored with a solo exhibition at the Smithsonian.
Wonderful. We're unfortunately going to have to leave it there. Go to what? Filmfest,
dc.org.
Got it right. Okay. I was hesitating about the Oregon. Well, yeah, no, this is nonprofit. It sure is.
Right.
Nobody's making a lot of money on this.
No.
I've been speaking with the Arab Sites Film Festival Executive Director, Shireen Gharib. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
all you're doing. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Terrific. And on to our last guest with a career that spent 50 years. D.C.'s very own American icon, Edward Kennedy Duke Ellington, is known around the world for such jazz standards as moved to take the analog out of stereotype boxes, explore broader creative horizons. On April 16th at the Kennedy Center at the Terrace Theater, the innovative post-classical ensemble will journey through the music of Duke Ellington's extraordinary yet little-known concert pieces, including his magnificent black, brown, and beige, and the suite from the ballet The River. And joining us to talk about this wonderful event is the Post-Classical Ensemble's musical director, Angel Il Ordóñez. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
David, this is always such a treat to be with you and your audience and to discuss music with you, our favorite cellist in town. And anyway, thank you very much for having me.
Forgive me, I should have called you maestro. I apologize.
Please, don't even think about calling me maestro. I'm too young to be called maestro. Maybe when
you're
80.
You're too young. Okay. Is maestro, I didn't know there was a seniority element to maestro.
No, I mean, that's...
So, just real briefly, for folks that aren't familiar, this is not your normal classical entity ensemble. This is post-classical, and every time you go to a performance of theirs, you know, you're going to be pushed outside of the norm. You know, they push the edges here. Just what would you describe as the mission of the post-classical ensemble?
Well, in this is a very excellent example of what we are interested in. I mean, such a universal figure like Duke Ellington, probably the most important treasure of Washington, D.C. in history. We are celebrating 125 years of his birth. So, but what we do is precisely to show a different face of Duke Ellington. I mean, there is no doubt that he was an incredible innovator in jazz, in all many, many different styles in jazz. But what people might not know, and this is somehow a post-classical ensemble specialty, is what other interests had Duke Ellington. And he wrote music for a symphony orchestra, concert music, actually symphonic poem, this extraordinary piece that you mentioned, Black, Brown, and Beige. People might not know that he wrote an extraordinary music for an extraordinary ballet, The River, that actually was commissioned by Alvin Ailey, the director of the American Dance Theater. And also, people might not know that he wrote music for film, the famous Anatomy of a Murder by Otto Preminger. So this is what post-classical ensemble specialty is to present extraordinary music by composers that are not as... Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I lost you for a second. Sorry, David, I lost you for a second.
I don't know if I'm being heard by folks, but the Zoom thing maybe needs to go. So it looks like quite an evening you have planned for. 16th if we've got, you know, a couple of minutes on Hill, if you as well called El Sistema, if you could just touch on that, it's something that might sound distant, but it even is shown in the wonderful work of our DC Youth Org. If you could talk about El Sistema and your involvement with it.
Yes, so thank you, David, for mentioning this. I started a program in Mexico, in León, in the state of Guanajuato, 14 years ago, that we called Academia Renacimiento, or the Renaissance Academy, which is actually a musical program inspired in the famous Venezuela's El Sistema, which is bringing music, making kids in, for unprivileged children, to give them an instrument and being part of an orchestra. And this is an incredible way to change a community and a society, to bring dignity, to bring creativity to these incredible, brilliant kids that are neglected. And it's actually really very successful. We have every year about 300 kids, and it's really a phenomenal experience. I would say basically three things that are crucial in this program, in general, in music. So music gives these kids dignity first, as I said, discipline. They learn something that I think is even more important nowadays, which is everything that is crucial and important in life, it takes years. It's long term. You know, when you play an instrument,
right.
So we are in a society of instant gratification. We go to our cell phone and we have a library there. So, but playing an instrument is something that takes time, and you have to value the taking time to create important things. And then, of course, being part of an orchestra, what a better way to learn, be a civic person than being in an orchestra in which sometimes you are talking, sometimes you have to listen to the others playing. There is somebody that knows the whole and conveys you the idea. So this is an orchestra is the perfect society, you know, it's the most extraordinary society you can imagine. So I'm very happy and proud about this program, and it's very rewarding going every year there to see how the kids are evolving.
It's wonderful. So how did you find this particular program in Mexico, or how did they find you? I mean, it's just so terrific. And we should say that this is, you know, classical music can be, you know, somewhat sniffy, if you will, whatever the right word is, ivory tower. But, you know, the sistema is all about getting, you know, the opportunity to people that otherwise might not have it. I mean, I don't know the economic background of the soon-to-be conductor of the New York Philharmonic, Dudamel, uh-huh. But he's the most famous product coming out of Venezuela of this. And, you know, I could be wrong, but, you know, and he shouldn't be the only example. It's the only example I know in terms of celebrity. But it's a system that is all about providing this opportunity to a broad spectrum of the populace, of kids of every economic level.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, and actually, in which we separate a little bit from the sistema is that our goal is not that these kids become musicians. Our goal is that these kids have a musical experience that will
indeed
make them better human beings. And
right.
The reality and the gratification is that we already have, because they play an instrument, they are getting scholarships in universities in Mexico to study things like, engineers, doctors, etc. So many of our alumni, thanks to our program, have been able to get scholarships to study and to
wonderful
in other
But, you know, but it's an end in it, the musical experience, regardless of that, the musical experience is an end in itself.
Absolutely.
No matter what happens in terms of your career. We just had someone on this has an incredible program in Haiti, and it's similar. You know, it's creating leadership, creating all kinds of opportunities through music. But no matter what happens in that regard, you get that musical experience, and it's elevating. We are out of time. Where can people get more information about your Duke Ellington homage on April 16th?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the bad and the good news is that we have been sold out for more than 3 weeks.
Yes,
I know. It's incredible. This is
you're gonna just have to go down there and, you know, bang on the doors and try.
Absolutely. Bang the doors.
We will find this. Sneak in at the intermission, you know, it should be.
We'll be right back. Dori Ladner was a courageous civil rights activist. Her legacy lives on every time we choose to confront injustice. Dori Ladner's funeral will be held this Saturday, April 13th, at Shiloh Baptist Church, 1500 9th Street, Northwest, D.C., at 11 a.m. All are welcome to come and bid farewell to this icon of the civil rights movement. WPFW extends condolences to the family of Dori Ladner.
The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. To complete the survey, please click the link on WPFW's website. Because we need your input, the deadline for the survey has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Tuesday, April 9th. Here are some headlines. In a filing last night, Special Counsel for the Department of Justice, Jack Smith, asked the Supreme Court to reject former President Donald Trump's claim of presidential immunity from charges of plotting to overturn his 2020 election loss. Trump has claimed immunity from prosecution for official acts in office. Special Counsel Smith told the court that, quote, a bedrock principle of our constitutional order is that no person is above the law, including the president, close quote. The Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments in the case on April 25th. And its decision could have wide-ranging consequences, not only to Trump's election subversion case, but the other criminal indictments he faces. In related news, a New York appeals court judge yesterday rejected Donald Trump's last-minute attempt to delay his hush money criminal trial that is set to begin Monday. Trump's lawyers asked at an emergency hearing that the trial be postponed indefinitely while they seek a change of venue. They argued the presumptive Republican nominee faces potential prejudice in heavily Democratic Manhattan and said the jury pool has been polluted by news coverage of Trump's other recent cases. In this case, Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsification of business records in a scheme during the 2016 presidential campaign to cover up an alleged affair. In a video statement yesterday, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he has set a date for a military offensive into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, despite warnings it could lead to high civilian casualties. Over half of Gaza's population, an estimated 1.5 million Palestinians, have fled to Rafah after being displaced by fighting in other parts of the territory. The United States, Israel's closest ally, is opposed to an assault on Rafah and has demanded to see a credible plan to protect civilians. But Israel says it must move into the city to defeat Hamas. Netanyahu's stated commitment to the offensive comes as he faces calls by right-wing allies in his own government to intensify military actions against Hamas. And the European Union's Climate Change Monitoring Agency reported today that the world has experienced its warmest March on record. according to the Copernicus Climate Change Service, March 2024 was 1.68 degrees Celsius hotter than the pre-industrial era, and marked the 10th month in a row of